from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The old real estate adage, location, 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 sometimes seems irrelevant in the Bay Area, where no matter where you look, the cost of housing is high. But if the Bay Area seems like a uniformly pricey place, there is one South Bay community where location is at a crossroads in contradictions. Silicon Valley surrounds it, Facebook is at its front door, but East Palo Alto is different. Yes, housing costs are up there too, but living in East Palo Alto involves different challenges and opportunities. We'll explore them as part of Priced Out, our continuing series examining the high cost of living in the Bay Area. East Palo Alto, our focus next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Tens of thousands of Silicon Valley commuters buzz by every day, back and forth across the Dumbarton Bridge, going by Facebook, up and down Willow Road or University. The South Bay community of East Palo Alto sits at a crossroads where location, demographic change, opportunity, and challenge all intersect. The annual median income is $50,000. That's about $35,000 less than the countywide average. The housing challenges are different, too, where both rents and evictions have spiked in recent years, where overcrowding is a problem compared to the rest of the county. But there's also a rich diversity and cultural tradition in East Palo Alto that sets it apart from its blander neighbors. This morning on Forum, we focus on living in East Palo Alto as we continue our Priced Out series exploring the cost of living in the San Francisco Bay Area. Joining us, Annie Loya. She is the executive director of Youth United for Community Action, which is an East Palo Alto youth community organization. Annie Loya, good morning.
Good morning. All right, thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you here. Ruben Abrika joins us as well, city council member and former mayor of East Palo Alto. Good morning.
Yeah, thank you.
And joining us as well is Bob Hoover, director of the David Lewis Community Reentry Center in East Palo Alto, also director of the East Palo Alto Junior Golf Program. Bob Hoover, good morning to you.
Thank you.
So as I was describing in my introduction, there's a lot of driving by that it seems to me happens for residents of the South Bay. I would include myself as one of them who has made that trek down Willow Road, turning right by Facebook, going over the Dumbarton and back and forth many, many times without necessarily turning right or left and going into that community. So if I did that, if I didn't proceed and to cross the Dumbarton Bridge, Bob Hoover, and turned into the community, spent more time poking around, what would I find?
Well, you would find a very diverse cultural community. One of the few on the peninsula, with three primary racial groups: African American, Latino, and Pacific Islanders. You'd also find a community that has a lot of activity and has maintained its desire to be independent and struggle with that for all these years. And so it's an interesting place. It's an interesting place.
What would you want people to notice, Annie Loya?
I think it'd be very similar to your own community. You're a resident of Menlo Park, and it's very similar to the Belhaven neighborhood. The Belhaven neighborhood residents are facing some of the same issues that East Palo Alto residents are facing with regards to the increase in rental markets and the decrease of units available. You'll find a community, as Mr. Hoover mentioned, that is striving to preserve itself, that created a space for itself way back in the incorporation days that both of these men were a part of, and I get to now gain all the benefit from. But you find a community that is very well-knitted, that's very involved in our young people and constantly striving to be innovative and are very innovative and working with each other to preserve what was built.
It is strikingly young. I mean, you are about the average
age.
It's the median age is something like 28, mm-hmm. whereas the statewide median age, I think, is almost not quite double that, late 40s.
It's a very young city, yes.
And what is that offer? What are both the challenges and opportunities that that engages?
Well, it offers a lot of energy, and it offers a lot of people wanting to be involved. We have a number of youth serving organizations, a number of young people looking to work with our young people, and young people being very involved. We have young people creating applications, mobile apps. We have young people participating in city planning processes. We have young people creating arts and music. We have young people in sports. And so it's a very energetic community.
What would you add, Ruben Abriquez, a former mayor, now on the city council, of and the kind of tour that you'd like to take people on of East Palo Alto?
Yes, I think we would invite anyone to come by, and I think they would see a very vibrant community. People are always getting ready to go to work, or they're engaged in some activities. We also have, many churches. There's many faiths in our community. Historically, I think it's been a place also where people have settled down their roots in their own traditions, in addition to the ethnic diversity, language diversity. We also have a shopping center. That is part of it. We now have an IKEA. We have a Mi Pueblo supermarket. We have places where people can also come and shop and be part of our community while they're there. I think that we have become over the years a very diverse in many ways, even economically, although we're still primarily moderate and low income with all the challenges that it entails.
I wanted to ask that question as a way of beginning, because I think many people still have an image of East Palo Alto, formed in the 90s, perhaps, when the murder rate was high, and there's an image of what is there that may not be accurate anymore. Yet having said that, there are big challenges facing East Palo Alto. And as a way of preserving what you'd like to preserve, but also providing more for people who are there, how would you enumerate those challenges, Bob Hoover? What is it that needs to happen in East Palo Alto that isn't happening yet?
As I said earlier, the economy of Silicon Valley is a formidable issue for us. And trying to put together strategies that, and I don't know if protect is the right word, but preserve, I guess, maybe is a better word, the community for the people that have been there and that live there now, and trying to not only use the city's resources, but also the resources of the nonprofit community. And one of the major things that is kind of missing, and I'm hoping that we can bring them to the ball game, to the table over the next few years, is the corporate involvement. And I think that's one of the real major pieces that we've got to somehow figure out a way to.
You've got, an iconic one right at your doorstep, right. Facebook in particular. Right. What do you want from them?
I'm sure Ruben has a different answer than I do. what I would like to see, and we talk about, or we don't, I don't say necessarily, but there's been this conversation in this country for a long time about corporate citizenship. And what does that mean? For me, I think it means not just having a physical presence. It means having an involvement socially, culturally, in those ways, and participating in the life of the community. And also financially, I think you need to be a part of the community in all of those ways.
Are you getting that from Facebook or other neighboring Silicon Valley large corporations?
And not at this point.
Yeah. Would you agree with that, Ruben Abrika, that you're not getting the kind of involvement from Facebook and others that you'd like to see?
I think it could increase. I would add that East Palo Alto, I think we're facing now a situation that I think many people don't want to talk about. And because I think the reality is that there are two Silicon Valleys. Hmm. And so we represent part of the maybe in between. There's a Silicon Valley with a lot of wealth, a lot of jobs, a lot of energy in that direction. There's a Silicon Valley, not only in East Palo Alto, there's pockets everywhere. Not enough jobs. We always have twice the unemployment rate of the county. I agree with Bob that there needs to be a much more intense involvement with the corporate sector, probably, I think, in a more structured way. Mm-hmm. I think they could become investors. Mm-hmm. They could become investors along with city government. I'm for that. I think that public-private partnerships, but at another level, because now I think there are foundations, there are ways in which money comes into the city, it helps. But again, you know, some of our problems are like the country's problems. They're structural, they're long-term, but we need to now, I think, try different things that could generate additional jobs in the community, but that are very consciously done in conjunction with the private sector. And, you know, I don't have the answers, but I think we need to move in that direction.
What are some of your thoughts on that, Annie Loya? I mean, it seems in some ways there could be a pretty ready-made match. When you think of Facebook and the culture it represents, young people, and the fact that East Palo Alto is such a young, young city, it seems like there ought to be some sort of way to merge those common interests.
I think you're correct. There ought to be a way that for those conversations and dialogue to take place. It's an interesting discussion. And East Palo Alto, again, I think is just one of the stories that a lot of communities are dealing with. But even when Facebook moved in to the neighborhood, there was a potential litigation that would have taken place between the city of East Palo Alto and the city of Menlo Park with regards to the environmental impact report that was done showcasing some of the potential environmental impacts that Facebook would have. It is a facility that was once owned by Sun Microsystems that had a top employment number of 3,000. Facebook wants to increase that number to close to 10,000 employees. What is that impact? And what is the traffic impact for a city that's been a thoroughfare connecting 84 to 101? In 1997, there was an estimated 37,000 cars that went down University alone. And we're talking about 2.5 square mile city here. And so the environmental impact is also very real. And mobile sources, we know, is a huge concern in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. The state is looking how to reduce those numbers. But there's some communities that receive that burden. And so when the discussion of Facebook was brought to the table, there were initially those in community benefits that we were hoping to receive with such a huge company. But I think there's also a culture with some of the budding technological groups and companies of figuring that out as well. And we want to be able to create a platform and a stage that those discussions can take place and that all the parties are at the table.
It seems like there should be a lot of possibility with those potentially extra thousands of employees. More money could be spent in East Palo Alto. There could be more of those workers living in your community, which would increase tax revenues and so forth. What's holding that back, Bob Hoover? As you've been a part of that community for a long time and you've seen the ebbs and flows of that. What do you think holds those potential benefits at bay?
excuse me. I think some of it over the years has been the image of the community. But we're at a point now, I think, where the economy of Silicon Valley is, and Facebook is just one example, where the growth of employment is so huge that the convenience of living close to where you work is so attractive at this point. That we will see that will eventually change the thing. And we see that. Now, we were talking about this earlier about what's happening in terms of the buying of property in East Palo Alto. And I think most of that is based on the speculation that they're going to be able to sell these properties to.
So it's the specter of gentrification.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And do you regard that as a real and present danger to what ought to be, what you'd like to see preserved, to use your word earlier?
I think it's real for sure. Over the last year and a half, probably.
It's present.
Yes, absolutely.
It's real and present.
It's real and present.
Houses would come on the market in East Palo Alto, and within 2 days, they were gone. And that's still true today. And who's buying those houses? Investors. Why are they buying those houses? Speculating for it's not to rent, maintain the current rent to the people in our community.
The percentages on that are astonishing. As I recall, when I was reading up on this, something like, is it half of all purchases now are from people who live or who don't live in East Palo Alto, but they're buying them for speculative? Is that right, Annie Loy?
Absolutely. I'm I'm looking for a home myself. I've worked in the, I grew up in the city, and I'd like to stay in the city. And you know, I make a very modest salary being a organizer in our community. And you know, as many years that you've invested in the city, you definitely want to be able to raise your family there. I love East Palo Alto. And just to give an example to Bob's story is that we were looking for a home. It needed a lot of work. It was on the market for $475,000. It sold for $673,000 cash, $200,000 above asking price, which considerably isn't much if you compare to what the bottom cost of housing in Palo Alto and your neighboring in our neighboring cities. And so we've spoken to some of the new residents, of which they've said, hey, I'll pay a couple $100,000 less. I'm still in a very great neighborhood. I'm in Silicon Valley still. You know, we'll if the violence, quote unquote, is an issue, there's violence everywhere. And people are making peace with moving into East Palo Alto. And yeah, it's very concerning that our residents that have lived in the community, that have lived in the rental market, saving up for this opportunity, aren't able to
purchase. That you're being priced out.
I'm being priced out.
So how do you change that? How do you take advantage of the fact that East Palo Alto could be hot, right? I mean, there's a lot happening there. It could be a really hot place to live, and yet it's who gets to live there, Ruben Ibrica? Is that really the challenge?
Well, talking about speculation, in April of this year will be 30 years that the voters of East Palo Alto voted to have a rent stabilization law. And we did it during that time. I served on the city council then. We did it because there were some people speculating on the housing market. So this is not a new phenomena, but it's very, very intense now because it's at the corporate level. It's not just a landlord or, you know, a small group. These are now corporate interests that are trying to basically, I think, gentrify our community once and for all. On the other hand, I think the city has shown we have a rent law. We have put in a condominium conversion law. We actually have done a lot, city government, because our community really has struggled not only to survive but to grow. And so, but this is a tough one. I just want to mention one other thing, that this period coincides with the end of redevelopment,
right,
which unfortunately has hurt us. Other communities perhaps were not hurt, but we are hurt by that.
You're referencing and Governor Brown's decision
yes,
to do away with the redevelopment funds.
With all due respect, you know, to state government, but they have left us now in the woods because we're still waiting to see the state. You know, on the one hand, the corporate sector has to get, I think, more consciously involved in structural ways. But the state of California has yet to put something in place for communities like us in order to deal with these economic forces. You can't deal with them just, you know, we all do what we can, even city government. We're a small city, but we need some assistance from the other level.
And we're seeing more and more of those tools being stripped away from cities. For example, even with the rental market, inclusionary zoning, which is in a city that's developing that can have room for potential higher density housing. Without the support of inclusionary zoning to mandate construction of affordable units, you continue to leave low-income residents out of the picture.
So I want to stay for a moment. I want to come back to this question of what the state can do. And maybe it's the answer to the question that I'm posing, Bob Hoover. But let's just stay for a moment on how Annie Loya gets to buy a house. So how does that happen? I mean, is it that we need redevelopment funds or that we need something that will construct more housing? But that's who you want living in East Palo Alto,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
So how do we get there?
I'm not sure that the buses may be gone on that one, but let me just speculate for a minute what I think I don't know whether it's still possible or not, but when the housing bubble burst and left us with all of these foreclosed homes, I think many communities missed an opportunity to form a partnership with HUD, with the banks, and with the cities that were involved in this, along with the moderate low-income housing developers like Mid-Penn Housing. There's an organization in East Palo Alto called ABLE. There's EPA Can Do. if we could have bundled those organizations with the city and the HUD foreclosed properties, I think we could have been in a position to preserve houses and spaces for people like Annie.
It's a great point. I mean, the number of foreclosures, it had the highest foreclosure rate of anywhere in the county, and something like a third of all homes in East Palo Alto went into foreclosure from that time, from 2008. But why can't that be done? Why not? Why can't those – you're part of government, Ruben and Brica. Why can't more of those partnerships be formed? Why can't we get more done?
We have done partnerships.
Too late.
You know, that – I mean, I think this whole thing of the – for the most recent crises, it happened so quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the people with the money right away were the ones who took advantage. We actually did work with the Habitat for Humanity. We entered into a certain partnership, but it was on a small scale.
Right.
Right? And so, again, you know, this is a situation where the least get asked to do the most. So we're not a wealthy community, you know. We don't have all the resources that many other communities have, but we are prepared. We put in place certain laws. We have a lot of community groups that always come to the fore to resist these forces. But, you know, let's face it. Let's not pretend that every community is the same, that every city is the same. It's a very deep, unequal system that cuts through not only individuals, families, but the cities themselves, the entities. So I'm all for local control, but that's why I feel that, you know, Palo Alto never had to have a redevelopment agency because, you know, they didn't need it.
Exactly.
And all you know, that's great. We needed to have redevelopment, but now without another mechanism that helps us, I think it's going to be a tough situation.
So it's a bit like, you know, the state just changed how it funds schools and changed the formula so that more money would be directed towards schools that have a higher percentage of either English language learners or poorer kids or more minority kids. Is that sort of what you think needs to happen from the state also, Annie Loya, that something ought to replace redevelopment so that the communities like East Palo Alto, as Ruben Abrika says, Palo Alto may not need a redevelopment money, but East Palo Alto does.
I don't think there's any mechanism right now that could replace redevelopment. It was a very useful tool for a city like East Palo Alto that can pool funds, that it could be regulated, you can hold it accountable, and you can see where the dollars are going and how they're being invested. The state is continually to cut funds from education and, again, asking residents to – we're increasing sales tax, we're increasing property tax, we're increasing all these taxes, and more burden is being placed on homeowners and residents. And there's a lack of accountability to be able to really say how these funds are being used and where are these funds going. We're spending trillions of dollars on this war, and what has the country been able to benefit from it? To Ruben's point, the cities now are being forced to become more creative to be able to deal with some of these issues. To the two Silicon Valley communities Ruben spoke of, our residents also are the infrastructure of Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley cannot operate without the service industry. And so it's very important that we're also looking out for everyone and that it becomes an inclusive process.
And we'll pick up on exactly that point when we return about where are the people who make Silicon Valley work in many ways, where they're able to live, and what the future of East Palo Alto holds. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'd love to hear from you as well, especially if you live in the East Menlo Park, or in East Palo Alto area rather, or in East Menlo Park, the Belhaven neighborhood. We'd love to hear from you about the future of that community. You can join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our focus today is East Palo Alto. It's part of our continuing series called Priced Out, about the challenges of living in a high-cost area like the Bay Area. We're focusing today on East Palo Alto, its challenges and its opportunities. Joining us are three people who know East Palo Alto well. Annie Loya is the executive director of Youth United for Community Action. Ruben Abrika is a city council member and a former mayor of East Palo Alto. And Bob Hoover is the director of the David Lewis Community Reentry Center in East Palo Alto. We'd welcome your participation as well, especially if you live in East Palo Alto or in that area. We'd love to hear from you at 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, or today it'd be particularly appropriate if you wanted to post a message on our Facebook page. That would work well also. Couple of notes coming in. Jorge writes, unfortunately, the unintended consequence of your show today will be to flag this community to the high techies, and they'll begin to view this area as a good place to live, and they'll buy up the community. Sorry, Annie Loya. We're being self-defeating, apparently, according to Jorge. Derek writes in, I'm a software engineer living in Menlo Park. I've lived here for years. Now I'm being evicted without cause. The only explanation is to increase our rent. How much is that going on, Ruben Abrika? There's been a lot of concern about evictions in the last year or so.
Well, last year the city actually commissioned a little study because we were getting a lot of complaints. It did show that there was a spike in 3-day notices and eviction notices. And once again, I think because the housing market is so hot now that there are some unscrupulous corporations in particular who will do anything and everything to pressure people. We have a rent law in East Palo Alto, but there are ways in which people get pushed out, because then they can raise the rent. And so it is a grave concern, again, all throughout the peninsula and San Francisco. It's going on everywhere.
Right.
We have a rent law which actually helps in some ways, but in many other places, people don't even know this is going on every day. It's going on in Redwood City, in San Carlos, and San Jose, every place. That's why I point out to the two Silicon Valleys that, it's sort of a political and economic ethical issue that those people who are speculating on the market so much, maybe they shouldn't do so much of that, because it's really based on greed, ultimately.
Well, I want to pursue the question of the two Silicon Valleys in this next part of our program, but let's take a caller first who wants to also comment on the eviction question. Derek, go ahead.
Hi. Actually, I sent that email you just talked
about. Oh, well, you're getting double duty then.
All right. Well, I really wanted to talk about this because it's something that's actually dramatically impacting my own life. I'd like to say, it's interesting that people target software engineers or people in the tech industry as the reason for displacement or gentrification. But honestly, I think more of us want to live near jobs that we have at places like Facebook or Google or whatnot. And I'd rather us try to live in these places than commute, 50 miles to San Francisco and impact communities that our businesses aren't even really a part of.
And so your point, Derek, is that you'd like to live there, but you're being affected by this too, that the high rents are driving you out?
Right. I have to move even further south, or maybe even east, because I can't afford to live, I can't even, in this case, I don't even have the option to live in the place where I've paid rent successfully for 4+ years. I was suddenly just handed a eviction notice and with no recourse and no way to speak to my landlord about it.
Do you mind telling us, Derek, what you were paying and what you're now being asked to pay?
Sure. I've been paying, I started when I moved in 4 years ago, I was paying, I think, $1,500, and it went up to now $2,050 for a 2-bedroom apartment. And now with the through the eviction, I don't even have an opportunity to pay more rent. That's not even an option they've given me.
And you're being evicted because you have failed to pay that new higher rent, is that right?
No. Well, this is more of a notice of eviction if I don't leave peaceably within 60 days.
Okay.
Which in Menlo Park, she's completely within her right to do. Menlo Park has zero rent control laws. I spoke with the city and I have no recourse, and she's within her legal right. Maybe ethically questionable, but and so we're just kind of, having to go look for something else now.
Okay, Derek, thank you.
Yeah.
An apartment, I think. It seems like a catch-22. I mean, that you're popular, there are people who want to live there, and so that drives it up. It seems like a circular difficulty. How do you extricate yourself from that, Bob?
I don't know how you extricate, but certainly I think you're going to see more of this as the investors are buying property. They're not controlled by the rent control or the current things within the city. So they have the option, if they buy a house, they can turn around and sell it. They can evict people and turn around and sell it for additional property of a profit. And I think we're going to see more and more of this. There are a lot of renters of single-family homes in East Palo Alto, and I think that's where we're going to see a huge change over the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, to Derek's point, I wanted to mention, I'd like for him to look into Just Cause because, the rise of rent costs is not a just cause to evict. But also, it's an interesting case in Menlo Park, and I think in neighboring cities. Well, part of the litigation that I spoke of earlier with Facebook and with Menlo Park was because Menlo Park was in non-compliance with their housing element. It did not have an updated housing element for over 20 years. And one of the criteria in your housing element is to provide housing of different income levels, very mm-hmm. low income, moderate income, and so forth. And it was a battle in some cases to get the city of Menlo Park on board with developing these options. And when approached to the city of thinking about affordable housing, we were met with a lot of NIMBYs that has an idea of who affordable housing belongs to and what face belongs to affordable housing. And so when it comes to cities having to think about these tools and opportunities, and again, having to become more creative, you also have to have the residents on board also thinking about these tools, because then there will be cases like Derek. And imagine if Derek can pay a $2,200 a month rent, there are folks that can't.
Well, let's talk about those who can't and that other part of what Ruben Brica referred to as the other Silicon Valley, because there are people living in East Palo Alto who work for Silicon Valley industry. Some may be techie engineers like Derek, but others may be, you know, janitors or mowing the lawn in front of Google or all the rest. It's where they're making Silicon Valley possible, but it isn't possible for them to live here. Is that sort of the root concern?
It is one of the roots. I would say that a significant percentage of our population, I think historically, also has provided those kinds of jobs at the lower end, mid-level, and now it's much more difficult because we know that they're not getting higher wages. We know that those trends in the society are affecting them, that they're not making as much money, and so house prices go up, they make less money, they have to live with their families more, people right. are having to... you know, I think our community, we try to be together. We try to not let people just be out there. But it is difficult. On the other hand, I think that I'm optimistic that somehow I'm hoping that the state will provide in certain mechanisms that perhaps the city and some nonprofits can be more in the business of building more housing for different levels and try to get rid of the speculators on the housing market. Frankly, they are part of the big problem that mm-hmm. we have.
Yep. Let's take another call. Elizabeth joins us from East Palo Alto. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Yes, hello. I was born in unincorporated East Palo Alto, and I've lived here all 37 years of my life. And I think going back to what you were asking about how the different entities could get together to work together, I think one of the major problems in the city of East Palo Alto is ego in our elected officials and in people who imagine themselves to be in a position of power here. And I think also a lot of it has to do with the racial shift that's happened. East Palo Alto was mostly African-American when I was a child growing up, and now it's definitely mostly Latino. And just recently, the Latino voice has really started to be able to be heard, and I think that there's a lot of the African-American community that's tried to hold on to it, and there's been a bit of a power struggle in that, and even just in voting. I've seen firsthand a lot of disenfranchisement. That's not the right word, but disenfranchising of the Latino vote. I've been out at get out the vote things, and historically our poll workers are African American senior citizens, and I've seen it time and time and time and time again.
Let me ask you to just hold on that point. But stay on the line, Elizabeth. You may want to come back and ask you a follow-up question. But you've raised a lot of really interesting points, and there are ones that we should get to. The demographics of East Palo Alto have changed dramatically. 30, 40 years ago, about 60% of East Palo Alto was African-American. Today, it's just 16% and more than 60% Latino. What about the concerns that Elizabeth raises, Bob Hoover? You've been there through all of that time and before. What is there a real tension between Black and Latino community within East Palo Alto, and to what extent does that pose a real problem for its future?
You know, I think whatever tension there is between the two communities is probably more political than it is in other kinds of ways. And let me just give you an example. I run a junior golf program, and there are many nonprofit as well as youth athletic programs that are run by African American people. But the vast majority of our participants in those programs are Latino. And so my experience is that people will bring their children and engage with people if they think those people that are running those programs are going to help their children. And so I don't see the conflict at that level in terms of being able to be unified and support each other, especially around the issue of education.
So with education and sports, there's more of a common common interest that binds people together. The differences are more in City Hall?
Yes. And I think you see also in these organizations, you see young people coming together, forming friendships, having social relationships, and a whole lot of other things happening. But I think and even at the level of the political level, it's more of a, sometimes it's more of an imagined conflict than it is a real conflict.
How do you see that, Ruben Abricos, former mayor, Latino? Where do you see that?
Our community has been one of those so-called majority-minority communities for 40 years, right? Only difference now that we do have a shift in another direction. The first time I was elected to the city council, it was predominantly African-Americans. And so I couldn't have won without support from African-American voters. I would say that we have done pretty well overall as far as growing pains, because it is a growing pain process of many communities that are going through this. And so even in politics, there's times when, yes, that may become an issue. That is an issue. Issues of power, issues of resources, issues of perception, issues of language. But I think that I, for one person, I think Bob and Annie, all of us, there's a group of people, I think, that we have tried over the years to try to resolve some of the issues without it becoming bigger. So, you know, I think the caller pointed out a few things. I think there are some problems here and there, but considering the kinds of problems that could occur in some ways, I think we're actually doing pretty well. Right. And you have to remember that there are not that many communities. There's starting to be more and more, but this is something that many more cities across the state are going to go through. Is that how do you deal with multilingual, multiracial, multi-ethnic communities? On top of that, we're mostly low-income, moderate. Don't forget that part.
No, you can. I mean, you can make a real argument, I think, that East Palo Alto represents the future. I mean, that's the minority majority. All that's turned on its head now, and that's the way. That's the future of the state. And so, in that interesting way, East Palo Alto could be a really interesting case study and how that gets worked out. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? As a young person, how do you see that divide, if there is one, between blacks and browns and Pacific Islanders and whites?
Well, it's funny, I represent both communities. And the future of races being multi-ethnic. And it is a very interesting dynamic, and it was highlighted especially. I also served on the San Mateo County Supervisorial Redistricting Committee, and it was an effort of ours to also make sure that we were thinking of those communities. We were thinking of the communities that were majority-minority so that we can also increase voting power of historically disenfranchised communities, and wanting to make sure And believing that there's also common interest. I think in the case of East Palo Alto, the common interest, at the, especially for the topic of discussion, is protecting and preserving affordable housing and anti-displacement. We've seen it, the first wave of it, at the dot-com boom about 10 years ago. And we've seen so many of our residents flee to Stockton, flee to Fresno, flee to Tracy because housing costs were so much lower. And now we're seeing the second wave again as the tech boom is coming into play and more tools being stripped from cities. What are we? It is the time. It is the perfect stage, and it has been. The community has been continually growing the last couple of years to be able to think about how do we merge all of our strategies and innovative ideas. And I think that's where we're moving. That's what we're doing. We work as Yuka. I mean, our young people, similar to what Bob said, we have Fijians, Indians, Pacific Islanders, Latinos, African American. We have them all, and it is the space they're all come together because there are common issues around immigration and around anti-displacement, and that trumps everything else.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for raising all of this and getting this conversation going in that direction. I really appreciate your being able to call, but we should move on to another caller and get the views next of James, who also joins us from East Palo Alto. James, go ahead.
Good morning. My wife and I bought a house in East Palo Alto 10 years ago, and we have three children who go to Brentwood. And one of the things that's an ironic thing that I think contributes to the lack of community is the Tinsley program. Mm-hmm. And that's a program where people can have their children go to school across 101.
So your child goes to school in East Palo Alto, but people have the option of sending their kids to schools in Palo Alto or elsewhere in the South Bay?
Right. So you can have people who are here on H-1Bs who classify as Asian, and they'll pay a lot of money for a house in East Palo Alto, but their children will go to school over 101, and they're not part of the community at all.
Hmm.
I mean, and that makes the pressure on the house prices go up. Because now they can afford to drop down, you know, $200,000 more for a house, and they're not part of the community at all. It's almost like you've moved 101, you know, east.
James, thanks. But your kids go to school within East Palo Alto, is that right?
They do, and we're in the extreme minority.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not something that if I had a lot of money I would have done, honestly. But there aren't many options for people. That, my joke is that everyone's born east of the Bosphorus. But so, you know, I could easily self-declare as Asian and then have my children go over 101 also.
James, thanks for raising the issue. We haven't talked yet about schools. And Bob, you were saying before the program started about how key and central schools are to East Palo Alto's future.
Absolutely. I think that people talk about youth being our future all the time, but it's amazing to me how little we invest in our youth, and especially in education, in communities like ours. When we talk about Silicon Valley as a whole, you have to be also talking about the labor market, the potential employees, and communities like ours, who have such little revenue for education and such a great need, have a difficult time producing people who can qualify to work in Silicon Valley and then be able to afford the kind of housing that they're going to have to deal with 5 or 10, 15 years from now when they become adults. So, and not only that, but if you do not educate people, then you create also drags on the welfare system, on all kinds of other issues, crime, violence, whatever. And I think it's not just East Palo Alto. I think it's the country as a whole. I mean, you look at where we are internationally at education, and we're in deep trouble.
Is that a factor? Sorry to interject, Bob. Annie Loy, I hate to keep making you our case study here, but since we haven't found you a house yet, let me ask you about finding a school. I don't know if you're a parent or a prospective parent, but does that concern you as far as the kinds of schools that are available for kids in East Palo?
I think to James' point, education is a huge concern when you're a parent. I am a parent. I have a 5-year-old daughter who is in the Tinsley program. She attends Ormondale School in the Portola Valley School District, which is a wonderful school, and I'm really happy she's there. And it's attention as well. And let's also just have a history lesson. Tinsley program was also enacted in the response to the desegregation order brought by the Sequoia Union School District in 1976. In the same efforts to desegregate the schools, which was where we had Ravenswood High School in East Palo Alto, and who were forced to attend neighboring high schools, Menlo Atherton, Woodside High, at the time San Carlos High was available, and Carmont, that had to deal with racial tensions. And it was not the same requirement of white families to be forced to attend Ravenswood High School to really be able to receive the impact or the intended impact of this desegregation order. So in order to address that, there was a Tinsley program that then provided these options to continue to desegregate schools, but also provide diversity, much needed diversity, to some of the other schools. Now, my 5-year-old daughter is also dealing with some racial tensions, being one of the only colored girls in her classroom. And that is a risk I knew I had to take because of the education plight in East Palo Alto.
And is it because then you felt that what was in the best interest, which is in the end where every parent goes, what was in the best interest of your daughter was to have her go to school 10, 15 miles away in Portola Valley rather than in East Palo Alto?
If we want to think about, to Bob's point, being able to invest. Now, we also have a city that is mostly renters, including the homeowner. The homeowners do not live in East Palo Alto. So it's very hard to engage stakeholders if you don't live there. How can we get the homeowners in the room to say, this is what our community looks like. This is what needs to happen. We need everyone to be on board, and they're not present. Renters are present. So we have the renters. They're very involved. But when it comes to thinking about prices or strategies, financial strategies, they're very limited because they don't own those homes.
Let's get to some of the questions that are being listed. Lots of interest in this program this morning. Our phone lines are all full, and I'm sorry I've not done well with getting more of your questions in, but it's such an interesting conversation. So let's do our best to get through some in our minutes remaining. Sonia writes, is this the same East Palo Alto of the 80s? It used to be called the murder capital of California. Has that changed? Ruben?
It definitely has changed. I think that although we still have spikes in violence and homicides, but it's no resemblance at all to what was going on then. There's a much closer relationship between the police. I think the government has really emphasized community policing. There are many community organizations and people that work together. We have a ways to go, but it is a much safer community.
I'm now going to get probably another email from someone saying, now that you've made the argument that it's safer, you're going to have more pressure on people,
people
moving in.
It's an ongoing challenge, but it's definitely much better than it was. And as a matter of fact, I'd say, you know, again, our city in its 30 years history has made a lot of progress, and we just now face another hurdle.
We have a caller who wants to ask about Chinese investors. And this is something I've read about, too. And Lavinda writes in, I've heard this about foreign investors, money coming from China, people investing and buying. What do we know about that? Bob Hoover, Annie, Ruben, anyone? Is that something that's really going on?
A lot of the investors are Asian. And now where the money comes from, I have no clue. But there's certainly a lot of the investors that are buying up property are Asian.
All right. Joshua in East Palo Alto has our next call. Joshua, go ahead.
Hi. So first of all, I want to say hi to Dr. Bob and Annie Loy. Like I said, my name is Joshua. I work for an organization called Living Peace and lived in East Palo Alto for a while. We got priced out. We moved and tried to come back and couldn't afford it anymore. And I mean, there's a lot of richness to this conversation, but I think to Annie's point earlier about sort of the unity, there is racial tension, there's ethnic tension. I think that's seen all across the country. But getting folks to center problem is key, rather than kind of looking to your neighbor, because that's our tendency in low-income communities, is to say, things aren't going well for me, what has changed? But we don't look much further than our arm and getting to recognize the other forces at play. And I think a lot of community organizations, I think, Dr. Bob, Annie, to name a few, have done a lot of good work in helping to reconcile that. And engaging the younger population, which views this very differently than kind of the old guard and the protectionist mindset. And as far as the housing...
Joshua, I'm so sorry, but I'm going to have to hold you there because we're almost out of time. But I really appreciate your calling and adding your perspective. Just want to have you respond at the end here to your hopes for East Palo Alto and the sort of city you'd like to envision as in this young, vibrant crossroads community, adjacent to Facebook, adjacent to so much wealth, and yet having so much vibrance and culture within it. What would you like to see it become? Ruben first.
Well, I'd like to mention that as it turns out, this entire year, the city is going through a process, and we're inviting everyone in the community of revising our general plan, which is, in essence, a community visioning process. I think that's the most important thing, for people to be involved, for all of us to do that. I personally, this past year, in my State of the City address as mayor, I mentioned that preschool is something that I feel that somehow city government, with corporations perhaps, with families, we need to establish a municipal preschool system where every East Palo Altan, and so 10 years from now, I would like to keep working on that idea that we make sure every child starts with a strong foundation.
And briefly, Annie, and then Bob.
What I'd like to see East Palo Alto really starts with the state, really starts with resources, really starts with corporations being involved. I think it's a cultural shift. It's working in a way that we haven't done before. And to, in order to preserve East Palo Alto, I think some of those relationships have to be built.
Bob Hoover.
Well, I guess I have the dream that started years ago, and that is just simply to have a quality community where we can raise our children in a good environment, high quality education, and good housing, and be able to live and survive in this within the current city.
I want to thank Bob Hoover, Annie Loya, and Ruben Abrika for being with us as part of our program today. Really appreciate it. Interesting perspective, interesting window into East Palo Alto, a community that has so much ahead of it, I believe. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And our engineer today is Danny Brigger. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.